closing argument. Walter Hudson. Pursuing happiness thoughtfully. 8 to 10 weeknights on Twin Cities News Talk. AM 1130 and 103.5 FM.
There's a scene in Atlas Shrugged, the magnum opus novel by Ayn Rand, wherein Hank Reardon, an industrialist, a steel maker, the inventor of a new kind of metal that's tougher, stronger, and more capable than any that has come before it, is having a party at the behest of his wife, and he doesn't really like being there. He's not big into wasting time with social gatherings, particularly with the people that are involved, the people that are invited. And so he kind of sneaks away for a little bit, and he finds a window in his house, large window that looks out on the horizon. And he just sort of stands there for a while, and he watches as a storm gathers and makes its way towards his house. And he stands there and he appreciates the fact that he is, as a past man in a time long before his, would have responded to the sight of a gathering storm with panic. He gets to stand there completely certain, completely safe, and completely confident that he has nothing to worry about. And why is that? Why? Why does he get to stand there as master of his domain in the midst of a gathering storm? Something that all of us get to do, by the way, right? Like, we don't all have to be inventors of new metal products. We don't all have to be steel magnates or industrialists or the 1% or billionaires in order to benefit from this. Any of us who have access to a modern indoor space get to have this exact same experience that Hank Reardon had in Atlas Shrugged, of facing down the storm with a complete lack of concern and total confidence that we and our families, our loved ones, will be safe. Why? Because of the human mind, because of human ingenuity, because of the pursuit of the highest value at the lowest cost. And this is a lesson that Ayn Rand spent an entire novel trying to inculcate in her readers. And it's a lesson that is particularly appropriate for us to consider in lieu of the weather that we've been experiencing recently, particularly last week, where temperatures dropped down to 20 below and wind chills were down to 50 below. And it was a test, a strain on our energy system. We're going to talk about that tonight with Isaac Orr, a policy fellow from the Center of the American Experiment on Closing Argument. My name is Walter Hudson. Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM. Streaming at TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com and your iHeartRadio app. We are here 8 to 10 weeknights. It's always great having you with us. As we go along, you can join the conversation at 651-989-5855. Brad Omland takes those calls and produces the show. The plan originally was to have Isaac in studio with us, but we are once again, as you are well aware, here in the Twin Cities, experiencing extreme weather. And so we opted to go with a telephone interview. Appreciate you joining the show, Isaac.
Hey, thank you for being gracious enough to let me phone it in. I appreciate that.
Well, I was going to make you drive just to be on the radio. That's not a very good transaction. That's not the highest value at the lowest cost on a day like this.
Hey,
so,
appreciate that.
You had a piece in the Star Tribune that came out in recent days that has generated some response, and I want to get into the response here shortly. But before we do, I just want to give you the opportunity, in case people missed this editorial that you put out in the wake of the bitter cold we experienced last week, basically what your thesis is and the overall point that you're trying to make.
Yeah, absolutely. So last week, it was negative 24 degrees when I woke up, and I have this app. I mean, I'm an energy nerd, so I have this app on my phone. It's called Electricity Map, and it tells you what sources of electricity or energy are providing electricity to the grid in real time. And it was really interesting because when I looked at this electricity map for the Mid-Continent Independent Systems Operator, it's a system of 15 states in the middle of the country. Minnesota's part of it. It showed that wind was only producing 4% of the entire generation in this giant system, and it was only working at 24% of its installed capacity. So basically, we were relying for coal, or on coal, for 45% of our power, 13% was nuclear, and 26% was gas. So a lot of people think that transitioning to wind and solar is going to be really easy, and it's not going to have any potentially negative consequences. And I wanted to write this article just to let people know that, hey, that's not true.
So some clarifying questions that spring to mind is, you know, we can sample statistics to demonstrate any point that we want to make. Is the reason why the numbers break down the way that you just outlined because of the nature of these energy sources, or is it because of the barriers that have been placed in the way of the development of such energy sources? Like, where is government putting its thumb on the scales of this process, I guess, is what I'm asking.
So in Minnesota, government puts its thumb on the scales in favor of wind and solar, actually. We have a 25% renewable energy mandate that dictates that 25% of our electricity should come from renewable energy sources. And conveniently, they outlawed large hydro, which we could buy from Canada and already meet the standard. So it's the limitations for wind are physics and just the availability of high-powered wind at any given time. A wind turbine needs the wind to be between 7 and 9 miles an hour before it starts making any electricity, and it produces its peak electricity between 25 and 35, and the wind simply just wasn't blowing enough during that time.
You also talk about the state of nuclear power here in the state of Minnesota and the fact that we have a moratorium on the development of new energy. Is it your belief that if that moratorium was lifted, we would have the development of new plants?
No, not necessarily. I mean, nuclear, relative to coal or natural gas, is a lot more expensive to build. But they do have some advantages. People who are looking to reduce carbon dioxide emissions should probably be more in favor of nuclear power because it can deliver on command. That's the main thing about wind and solar that make it an unreliable source of energy. So people say, oh, well, you know, the wind blows about 33% of the time, so let's just use it when we use it. But we don't have any agency over that, which makes it really problematic. So I just think that having a law on the books that says we can't have any new nuclear power plants isn't going to incentivize anybody to explore that opportunity in Minnesota.
What is kind of, you know, as a policy fellow for Center of the American Experiment, what's your policy ideal in terms of what energy policy should look like here in Minnesota? Is it a lifting of mandates and regulations, or is it a restructuring of it? What's the ideal picture look like?
So I believe in a least cost system, and I think that looks at what's the installed cost. Does it make more sense to use the sources of electricity that we already have and continue that going forward? Because in a lot of ways, the coal-fired power plants that we have right now are like a car where we've just paid off the payment, and we've paid off the loan, so now we are at peak efficiency in terms of returning value, the highest value, for ratepayers in the state. And unfortunately, we have a regulated utility market which totally provides perverse for the utility company to build more electricity generation plants than we actually need.
I'm trying to wrap my mind around that. So the regulatory environment is such that they are, how could they possibly be incentivized to build more? Are they getting subsidized? Is that what you're saying?
No, this is why energy policy is so counterintuitive, because regulated utilities are not allowed to make a profit on each individual megawatt hour of electricity that they sell.
Uh-huh.
Instead, they get compensated by how much money they spent.
What?
Yes, it's called the rate of return, and this is going to blow your mind, Walter. They get 7.5% profit guaranteed on every single dollar of infrastructure that they spend. So when they get a new mandate, the utility company loves it because that gives them an excuse, essentially,
to spend
a whole bunch of wind turbines in the ground and make money.
So how is the profit being generated if not by subsidy?
Oh, it's being, well, we're subsidizing it.
Oh, so okay, I got it. Oh, through the
rate base.
I got you.
You're paying through it in our bills.
So it's in other words, they're skipping the tax middleman and just mandating the amount of money that we have to pay in order to keep the lights on.
You got it.
Wow. Yeah, you're right. You did blow my mind on that one. So there was a counterpoint that was published a few days after yours by amongst a couple other authors, Ellen Anderson, who has some legislative experience, and she's a Democrat. And one of the points that she makes right at the top, which I found compelling and want to ask you about, is she talked about the sources of energy for different purposes. So that on the one hand, we have the generation of electricity, which you reference in terms of the app that showed you where that was coming from. And then we have the generation of our heat. And the paraphrased thesis from her opening few paragraphs is that the electrical grid has nothing to do with how warm your house was during the cold snap last week. How do you respond to that?
I would say that's not true. So the thing about electricity is wind turbines are very variable, and it's really hard to scale up a nuclear power plant. In fact, you have to run those things on cruise control. And coal-fired power plants are very similar. So natural gas is used to increase electricity generation when the wind isn't blowing. So if we are using electricity or natural gas to generate electricity, that's obviously going to cut into the amount of natural gas that we have available for home heating.
Mm.
So it was interesting. I was at a committee hearing on Tuesday, and they were talking about the impact of a 50% renewable energy standard, House File 700, that was recently introduced. And a representative from Otter Tail Power said that when it gets too cold outside, they have to shut the wind turbines down, and they actually have to use electricity to heat the wind turbines. So when we're talking about increasing the mandate, right? So we had enough natural gas because we were able to ask 460,000 customers to turn the thermostats down. But a lot of people think, you know what we're going to do? We're going to replace these coal-fired power plants with wind and solar. But that's not true. We're going to replace it with wind, solar, and natural gas, and enough natural gas capacity in order to provide 100% potentially of the electricity that we'll need in the event that wind and solar are not producing any electricity. So if we had a situation like last week where we were running short on natural gas for home heating, there's a very good chance we're going to be choosing between electricity generation or home heating. So that's the nexus.
That makes a whole lot of sense. When we come back, we'll take your calls at 651-989-5855, and we'll continue to ask questions of Isaac Orr, a policy fellow at the Center of the American Experiment, regarding how your home gets heated and your lights stay on. Closing argument, my name is Walter Hudson, Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM, TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com. For the most part, no matter how bad the weather gets, with, you know, a few exceptions, hurricanes here and there, tornadoes here and there, no matter how bad the weather gets, for the most part, we're able to endure it. It becomes, at most, a annoyance, a difficulty. It slows things down. You know, it took me about twice as long to drive around today wherever I was going than it usually does. And is that annoying? Absolutely. But here I am, right? Like, I'm alive. I'm fed. I'm warm. I don't have to worry about my survival. I don't have to worry about scarcity. I'm going to make it. I'm going to be okay. And so are you. And that's because of the pursuit of value that has been enabled through our capitalistic system. And that's something that we should aim to preserve. Closing argument. My name is Walter Hudson, Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM. You can join a conversation at 651-989-5855. We've been talking with Isaac Orr, policy fellow at the Center of the American Experiment, and we'll bring Isaac back on. Isaac, we also have a call from a John in Prior Lake who wants to chime in. Welcome, John.
Hey, Walter and Isaac. I'm just catching up here in the tail end of the conversation. I just came out of the radio program listening in. I work in solar and wind power development, but I realize the need for natural fossil fuels
And my question for the specialist is, with the shortage of natural gas recently,
oh, there we go. I got it. Sorry, we lost that caller. It sounded like he was about to go into talking about the shortage of natural gas, Isaac. Is that an issue moving forward in terms of a lack of infrastructure? And if so, what needs to be done about it?
Yeah, I think Xcel is going to have to improve the redundancy of their system. So right now, we're still investigating, or Xcel is still investigating. I'm not part of the investigation. I'm just eager to see what it yields, to understand better why they ran out of natural gas. And part of it is some of their spokespeople were saying those areas, the Sherburne County areas, have grown faster than anticipated. But there's going to need to be new natural gas pipelines, especially if they're going to close down the Sherburne County coal-fired generators and replace it with a natural gas generator.
Shifting back over to nuclear for a moment, there's been indications that utility companies are trying to move away from their nuclear power plants, nuclear energy. I live out near Monticello, and there have long been rumors that that plant's going to end up closing down at some point here. What's the reason for that? Is it because it's no longer cost efficient? Are there government factors in play? And why does there seem to be this move away from that?
Those plants are going to need some investment. So right now it looks like in order to keep them operating through their initial licensing period, it's going to cost about $1.4 billion to keep them up and running. So that's one factor. Xcel is actually trying to keep them going a little longer, I think. But there really isn't any sort of policy help when it comes to regulating the nuclear power plants. Xcel has to pay in an extra fee because they stored nuclear waste on site because the federal government never got their act together. So there's a bunch of reasons.
Gotcha. Let's talk to Bob in Woodbury. Welcome to the program.
Yeah. Thanks for having me on. Hey, you know, your comment about, well, they get paid to invest as if they can invest recklessly kind of doesn't make sense to me because I haven't seen the price of electricity go up that much. I think we're at 12 cents a kilowatt hour, I forget. And then the other note is that the demand for electricity nationally has been declining over the years. And I apologize, I don't know if that's per capita or if that's a gross decline. But, you know, all this energy efficiency and LED lights and so on, actually the effect of those things are, they're actually having an actual impact on total national electrical consumption.
Yeah, I appreciate the call. Bob, your response, yeah. Isaac.
Yeah, so, well, that's a very interesting point. I'm glad Bob brought that up. Electricity demand has been flat since 2007, when we passed the Next Generation Energy Act. So there was really no reason to build another power plant, period, whether that's coal, wind, natural gas, nuclear, because we had adequate supply, right? And when you look at what electricity prices in Minnesota have done since 2007, they have increased 26% faster than the national average. Our electricity prices used to be 20% below the national average, and now we are above it in terms of residential costs.
So the final question I want to hit you with tonight is in regards to whether or not there's any valuable or value in these renewable energy sources that are so touted by so many in the discourse. Is solar and wind just not worth it in any capacity, or is there room in a market approach to actually have a kind of a diversification of the energy market in order to not put all our eggs in one basket, so to speak?
Well, I guess, would you hire a babysitter that doesn't show up all the time?
Personally, no, I would not.
Well, that's what I'm saying, right? So we don't know when the wind is going to show up to work or not. We don't know whether it's going to be cloudy. So are there some circumstances that it could theoretically be worth it? Sure, if natural gas was $10 an MCF instead of $3.10, it would be worth the marginal cost of installing that solar panel. But under these circumstances, we're paying a 7.5% profit to the utility when they install a solar panel. We're paying for the additional transmission lines, which are expensive. They're $1 million a mile. And we're paying additional property tax on something. And we're paying for two sources of electricity when we can only use one. So I'm going to just argue that they're not there yet, and I doubt they ever will be.
Isaac Orr, Policy Fellow for Center of the American Experiment. You can find more about them at americanexperiment.org. Appreciate you joining us tonight on Closing Argument, Isaac, and have a good day.
Yeah, you too.
Absolutely. All right. When we come back, we'll get into some of the news of the past couple of days. And boy, it is amazing. Closing Argument. My name is Walter Hudson, Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM, 651-989-5855 to join us. TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com. We're going to be joined at 9 o'clock on the phone by Steve Davidson, who's a spokesman for the effort to convene a convention of the states. And if you don't know what that is, you're going to want to tune in because it's fascinating, it's provocative, and it may be a mechanism, kind of a break glass in case of emergency type of constitutional mechanism for retaking our country in the event we completely lose control of it, which, you know, I would argue that perhaps we have. Certainly, if we're conservative and principled and want to see government that adheres to the moral impetus of individual rights. Closing Argument. My name is Walter Hudson, Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM. Streaming at TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com and your iHeartRadio app. We are here 8 to 10 weeknights. It's great having you with us. You can join us at 651-989-5855. Brad Omland takes those calls and produces the show. So she's finally done it. It's finally happened. The long-awaited apology has come from Senator Elizabeth Warren. She has apologized, finally, for calling herself a Native American. Now, I have some things to say about this. Quite a few things, actually. And, you know, some of it may be the type of stuff you expect, the type of stuff that you've already heard said, but a lot of it, I imagine, is stuff that you're not expecting and a direction that you're not expecting a conservative talk radio host to go. I'm actually going to defend Senator Warren a little bit on this one. It's never been, like, you know, in the spirit in which Trump has called her Pocahontas, whatever, it's a joke. It's she deserves, for as serious as she takes herself, she deserves to be mocked a little bit. So that's never, I've never been one of these people who's like, oh, you're calling her Pocahontas, that's so mean. Get over it. She's a grown woman. She can handle it, right? And it is ridiculous. Like, what she's, her side of this, there. When I say I'm going to defend her a little bit, the emphasis is on the little bit. I'm going to defend her in a very specific way. What I'm not interested in defending is her desire, her desperation to be able to lay claim to a minority status, because her motivation for doing so is in order to gain political currency and credibility amongst the intersectional minority hierarchy. As we all know, on the left, the more boxes you can check of minority statuses, the more power and influence you're supposed to be granted, right? So, you know, the hypothetical black transgendered woman, you know, I don't even know how that works. Like, trans woman, so you're a man and you became a woman, if that's more valuable on the left, or if being a woman who transitioned into a man but still has the past minority status of being a woman gets you more credibility. That's an interesting question that we need to ask Pastor Nathan Roberts the next time we have him in, is, you know, how does that whole currency work on the left? But be that as it may, we all know that this intersectional minority thing is, it's big time baseball on the left. Like, being able to lay claim to statuses is a real way to garner actual power and influence on the left. And so that was Warren's desire, her impetus, her motivation through this whole process of claiming to be an American Indian. It's not because she had some sort of, you know, profound identification with Native American culture. It's because she wanted the power that comes with being able to make that claim.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's the same with, like, being a veteran. Like, if something allows me to say I'm a veteran and have a benefit from that, I'm going to say I'm a veteran.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. And so, you know, there's there's an honorable way, and I'm getting ahead of myself a little bit here, but there's an honorable way to identify with a heritage that perhaps you don't have a majority of your background in. There's an honorable way to do that and a dishonorable way to do that. And that's a distinction that the left fails to make, but it's one that we ought to make. And Warren's appropriation, quote unquote, of Native American heritage has been largely dishonorable. From the Washington Post, Senator Elizabeth Warren said Tuesday that she was sorry that she identified herself as a Native American for almost two decades, reflecting her ongoing struggle to quiet a controversy that continues to haunt her as she prepares to formally announce a presidential bid. Her comments more fully explain the regret she expressed last week to the chief of the Cherokee Nation, the first time she said she was sorry for claiming American Indian heritage. The private apology was earlier reported as focusing more narrowly on a DNA test she took to demonstrate her purported heritage, a move that prompted a ferocious backlash even from many allies. Warren will be vying to lead a party that has become far more mindful of non-white voters and their objections to misuse of their culture. Now, that's the phrase that I want to focus on. Non-white voters and their objections to misuse of their culture. Here's my question. How does one go about misusing a culture? How is that even possible? I think we need to define our terms. What is a culture? I think a fair definition, you know, off the top of our heads, a culture is a set of values, a way of thinking, a set of traditions, behaviors, actions that people choose to take, activities that people choose to partake in, styles that people choose to adopt. That's what a culture is, right? Beliefs, thoughts, traditions, values. Nobody owns that. You can't tell me that you own your culture and that I'm taking it from you when I adopt portions of it. And you also have no standing whatsoever to object to my use of your culture, because I am not yours. I don't belong to you. I'm not your slave. I get to do what I want. If I decide that there are certain values and practices and traditions and styles that come from your culture that I want to partake in or adopt as my own or utilize for a completely different purpose in my own judgment, I get to do that. And you don't get to say anything about it at all. If I want to wear a headdress because I think headdresses are cool, if my you know, hypothetical daughter, I don't have one, but my hypothetical daughter or my wife decides she wants to wear a kimono dress, a Japanese dress, she gets to do it. Because she thinks it's cool. She doesn't have to be tuned in to where it came from and what it means and, you know, have some sort of blessing from the Asian nations in order to be able to wear that dress. She could do what she wants because she's a free-thinking individual human being. This idea, this is what bugs me about this more than anything else. And when I said I'm going to defend Elizabeth Warren a little bit here, this is specifically how I'm going to do so. Is Elizabeth Warren an idiot? Of course. We all know this, right? She's a moron across the board. And it was stupid of her to pursue this claim of American Indian heritage in order to get the bona fides that would serve as currency for her on the left. However, it annoys me to no end that she got drummed into having to apologize for it in this way on these terms. And in doing so, provide legitimacy to the notion that you can, quote, misuse somebody else's culture. She lent credibility to the concept of cultural appropriation, which, of course, is a nonsense term. It is impossible, impossible to appropriate. Actually, I take that back. There's one way. There's one way and one way only that you can actually appropriate somebody's culture. And that's to tie them to a tree, literally or metaphorically. Because if you take away somebody's freedom, then they are not free to act upon their values, their beliefs, their traditions, the things that they hold dear. And in that sense, you have taken their culture from them, right? By taking their liberty. That's the only way in which you can take something from somebody, is by taking away their liberty. You don't, by seeing somebody else do something or say something or wear something and going, oh, that's kind of cool, I think I want to do that too, takes nothing from them at all. Now, I think there's a legitimate complaint that people can make, and it kind of bears out in this whole blackface debate that we find ourselves in the midst in with the Virginia. Apparently, it's more than just the Virginia governor. Now, it seems like on my social media feed, you know, every other person apparently has done blackface at some point, which is amazing to me because I am black and I've never seen it. I've literally never seen anybody in blackface other than like Jimmy Kimmel on TV or Robert Downey Jr. in that fantastic, what was the movie called? Thunder something. And he gets a pass, like he's still Iron Man.
Tropic Thunder.
Nobody's trying to get him fired, you know. And he said and did all kinds of things in that movie that I think even if he'd done them today, they'd probably be calling for his head. But regardless, we've gotten to a point. The one legitimate complaint that you can have is mockery, right? Like, if you're being mocked, if the reason why somebody is adopting your cultural styles or your traditions or pretending to be like you is not because they think what you're doing is cool or they think your culture is cool or certain aspects of it are valuable or worthwhile and they sincerely want to adopt them, but because they're making fun of you. And if that's what somebody is doing, if somebody's dressing up as an American Indian to make fun of American Indians, if somebody's dressing up like a black person to make fun of black people, then you have a legitimate complaint against that person. They're being uncouth, they're being uncivilized, they're being reprehensible, right? But they're not appropriating something. Like, that's a specific complaint. That person's being a jerk. That person's mocking me, right? Like, that's the complaint in that case. But that's not what the left puts forward. The left tries to conflate actual mockery and actual denigration with simply adopting best practices seen from a culture that's not your own, which, by the way, is how human civilization has advanced throughout time. That's like how progress works, is by two people or two tribes or two nations meeting each other and comparing notes, being like, oh, you do that, you sew things like that. Wow, we've always done it like this. Your way seems better. I think we'll do it your way from now on, right? Oh, yeah, you guys have really figured out how to catch fish. You know, would you mind showing us? So we can adopt that part of your culture and make it our own. What part of that is disrespectful? It's not. It's not. The purpose of this cultural appropriation nonsense, and the reason why Elizabeth Warren has been badgered into apologizing for what she did, is not because of her motives. It's not because, you know, of her DNA test or anything like that. It's because of the value, the utility, the political utility on the left of maintaining division. Maintaining division. That's what it's all about. It's about the balkanization of the American culture. It's about keeping us from coming together, from being a melting pot, from thinking of ourselves as one, from thinking of ourselves as Americans who have constituencies from various ethnicities and various cultures, but we are all Americans. It's to keep us from that and keep us cloistered into groups that can then be pitted against each other. And that's as un-American as it gets. Closing argument. My name's Walter Hudson. Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM, TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com. As the price of a new house in the Twin Cities rises faster than most would-be buyers' paychecks, the debate is heating up over what's driving up costs and what to do about it. That from the Star Tribune. On Monday, a new report commissioned by a builders group pointed at municipal fees and regulations of the Twin Cities, which it argues are pushing up prices of new homes more sharply here than in other communities, making it nearly impossible to build a single-family house for less than $375,000. $375,000.
That's insane. Like, if you follow the Dave Ramsey rule of don't buy a house that's more than twice your income,
right,
you would have to make $187,000 a year.
I don't know how people do it. And I tell you, I drive around every day for my day job, and oftentimes in these new developments. And so I get to see these homes being built firsthand, and they're building them like, you know, gangbusters, like there's crazy demand. And the question that pops into my head every single time is, who are these people who can afford these homes?
I don't know. When I was doing Amazon deliveries, like, I would deliver in Woodbury to super nice houses, and you just want to stop and ask them, like, what do you do? Like, how much money do you make? Right. How much money did this house cost? Like, this is insane.
Tell me your life story so that I can develop a plan.
Yeah.
To, you know, it's too late for me, but then I can hand to my children and be like, this is what you need to do. You know, because it's insane. In Woodbury, I grew up in Cottage Grove, and so I spent a lot of time in Woodbury, and I'm very cognizant of how it has expanded, Woodbury and Cottage Grove, how they've expanded in the last 10, 15, 20 years. And it's astounding. And the quality of homes are ridiculous compared to what they were when I was growing up.
Well, in talking to a friend who works in real estate, she said that people nowadays take out as much mortgage as they can possibly afford. So they're house poor, essentially. And previously, before the TCJA, there was a huge incentive for, like, property taxes and house payments. That was a huge deduction, and actually I think the largest deduction that people were taking was the state and local taxes for property taxes and
right.
And their the interest on their mortgage
which
payments.
Is one of the things that the tax law that Trump and Republicans passed last year got rid of.
Yeah, so I think that incentive alone, unless states start making radical changes, I know New York is all up in arms about it.
Yep.
But unless states start making radical changes to their tax code, I think that change in the federal tax code could stop people from taking out jumbo mortgages.
The point that this raised with me when I read it earlier today about, you know, builders complaining about municipal fees and regulations and how it's inflating the cost of homes. I mean, there are a couple of different angles we could go at with this, but the first thing that comes to my mind is just the absurdity of the entire development process as it currently stands. And I say this as somebody who just got finished with a term on a city council. And I also served as a liaison to my city's planning commission during that time. And I'm currently on a planning commission. And, you know, what I'm about to say might get me in trouble, and that's okay, because I've never been one to avoid trouble. But I just kind of fundamentally object to the entire concept, the entire process. Here's what's happening. And I saw it time and time again throughout my term. You've got developers, realtors, homeowners coming to the city, you know, business owners in the case of commercial development, coming to the city council or the planning commission, which is made up of, depending on the city you live in, 5 to 7 people who very often have precisely zero experience or institutional knowledge regarding development, regarding construction, regarding realty, regarding the market, right? No knowledge to bring to bear whatsoever. And also, no actual legitimate interest or standing in how the whole process turns out. Like, they're not financially involved. They have nothing at risk. They have nothing to gain. So they're this disinterested, completely uneducated panel of people who gets to decide what's going to happen, gets to decide whether or not a development is going to go forward or be obstructed. And if it's obstructed, and if it goes forward, on what terms, right? And, you know, it obviously it works out. We've got plenty of development here in the Twin Cities. People are building those $375,000 homes, and somebody's buying them. But it leads one to wonder, what might life be like if we just eased up on the reins a little bit and let people make their own decisions with their own property and their own money? I have to imagine many of our housing problems, to the extent that housing problems exist in the Twin Cities, and we've had guests on who have indicated that they absolutely do, would go away because the market would meet the demand where the demand is, and it would have an explosive effect upon our economy. Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM, TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com. see break glass. We're used to seeing that usually around containing an axe or something to help break down a door in the case of a fire, to get to pull a fire alarm or something along those lines. But metaphorically speaking, there is a process embedded within our Constitution that we could break some glass to grab in the case of an emergency in order to restore our republic. We're going to talk about it here tonight with Steve Davidson, who comes to us advocating for the Convention of States here on Closing Argument. My name is Walter Hudson, Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM. Streaming at TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com and your iHeartRadio app. We are here 10 or 8 to 10 weeknights. Man, getting towards the end of the week, you can tell. 651-989-5855, the number to join us. Brad Omland taking your calls and producing the show. Let's bring on Steve. Welcome to Closing Argument. Appreciate you coming on, sir.
Thank you, Walter. Good to be here.
So the Convention of States, I got to tell you, this is something that I've been aware of for many years. I was part of the Tea Party from the beginning back in 2008, very active in this state. And the Convention of States was something that was talked about pretty much everywhere I went, whether it was a local Tea Party group or a national conference or, you know, anywhere where activists were gathered, rallies and such. There was always somebody, at least one person or a group of people, who were standing around advocating for the Convention of States. And it's something that, to the extent I've taken a look at it, I've always kind of dismissed it, and I've dismissed it on a couple of premises. One has been that I just felt like it was an unattainable goal, like the idea that we're going to hold a constitutional convention, that we're going to be able to amass the prerequisite political will to get something like that accomplished, just seems so far out of reach as to be kind of an academic sort of laboratory thought experiment. And the second sort of premise that kept me from ever really spending too much time considering it seriously was the fear that even if we were able to call a constitutional convention, that it would end up being governed by the same political forces that are polluting our current public discourse and our politics. In other words, the process would get hijacked and end up being steered towards the left. And as I review some of the information on your website, which is conventionofstates.com, people can go check out and take a look at some of the information that you provide available. It's my understanding that there's some answers to those and other potential objections. But before we get into those, I just want to kind of give you an opportunity to kind of introduce people to the concept of what the Convention of States even is and what the vision is for what it could accomplish.
All right. Thank you, Walter. Well, I think, you know, there's been a resurgence, I would say, in just the last few years. Certainly, Mark Levin's book, The Liberty Amendments, had a lot to do with that. There have been at least five other books written about it. And I think also what's really brought it to the forefront again is the growth of a grassroots movement that is now 3.7 million people strong across the country. And people are starting to understand how this can actually work. Your premise about an unattainable goal, I shared that same feeling. A friend of mine loaned me the book, Liberty Amendments, Mark Levin's book, and I read it, and like you, I thought, well, yeah, this is really interesting, but how can it really ever happen? But as I started to see more information about it and realize that if we can grow the grassroots and people really understand this process, which is definitely happening now, it actually could happen. It's attainable. And that's what really drove me to jump in, and I've been involved for about 4 years now. And as far as fear of being governed by, I guess, the wrong elements, so to speak, the research in just the last few years, or let me back up, the opposition has been around for decades, same old story, and the sources of information that they quote, they really established their statement or their objective first, and then they went and tried to find things in the literature that might support their already solid position that was that this would never work, this could run away, it'd be dangerous, and so on. While in recent years, Professor Robert G. Nadelson, Professor Michael Ferris, others, including Mark Levin and other folks, have gone at it from the other direction. They've started with original source documents and really studied those as well as the original intent of the Founding Fathers, and the outcome is quite different. It becomes very doable, and that's where we are today, and that's really exciting because as more and more people understand the full process here, how it works, it's going to happen. We don't know when, but it's going to happen.
Yeah, as I peruse the website, which again is conventionofstates.com, I'm struck by, you know, as you get to the bottom of the page, and there's all these testimonials from conservative luminaries. And just to give one example, Ben Shapiro says, "I absolutely support the Convention of States project, designed for fulfilling the constitutional methodologies for protecting our rights. Article 5 exists so that the people have the final say, not the federal government. Yes, it can happen, and yes, it should happen. We should begin by completely restructuring the non-constitutional federal executive bureaucracy. Only Congress has constitutional legislative authority. Administrative agencies should not be making law. If you believe the people should decide instead of Washington, D.C., then you should support the Convention of States project." And there's several other people, you know, of note: Colonel Alan West, Charlie Kirk, Senator Ben Sasse, Rand Paul, James O'Keefe. I mean, you go down the list, and it's a very impressive lineup of people who are behind this.
It is a huge list, and I'd invite people to go on to conventionofstates.com, click on resources, and then find the endorsers. And I mean, it is an impressive list. It's grown enormously in the last year. And you mentioned Ben Shapiro. It's really exciting to have kind of a youth movement there, along with Charlie Kirk and Pete Hegseth, other younger generation, I guess. It's just not all us white-haired folks doing this. But would you like me, Walter, to walk through how it actually would come together? Is that something you'd
That's like exactly the direction I was about to take us. So how does this process work?
Well, we're talking about Article 5 in the United States Constitution, and this, of course, is the article that deals with amending the Constitution. It reads, "The Congress, whenever two-thirds of both houses shall deem it necessary, shall propose amendments to this Constitution." Now, that, of course, gives Congress the authority to propose amendments to the Constitution. But late in the Constitutional Convention of 1787, led by Colonel George Mason, the founders realized that, wait a minute, if only Congress can propose amendments, then the Congress should become overpowered or dysfunctional or abusive in any way. The people would be left out in the cold. They would never propose amendments to reduce their own power. And
right.
So the second clause in Article 5 was added, and I would mention that it was added by unanimous vote of the Founding Fathers, which was unusual in the Constitutional Convention. So the second part is as follows: "Or the Congress, on the application of the legislatures of two-thirds of the several states, shall call a convention for proposing amendments, which in either case shall be valid to all intents and purposes as part of this Constitution, when ratified by the legislatures of three-fourths of the several states, or by conventions in three-fourths thereof." And maybe three things to point out in this very clearly written language. First is the word "shall." Congress shall call the convention for proposing amendments. That's the word "shall," with its legal implications, means mandatory. Congress
right.
will have no choice in the matter once two-thirds of the states pass the request to hold this convention of states, if you will. The second thing, in two places in Article 5, it talks about shall propose amendments to this Constitution, not a new Constitution, not rewriting a Constitution, amendments to this Constitution. Their intent was very clear here. But probably the most important thing to understand is what the Founding Fathers called this. They called it a convention for proposing amendments, not a constitutional convention or a con-con. Those are misleading terms used by many of the opposition folks. a constitutional convention, or their favorite con term, by definition and connotation, means a convention that could rewrite the whole Constitution.
Yeah, and just to put to emphasize that point, that has been something that I personally have been confused about in the past. In fact, you know, even up to this very moment, to be completely frank. And my fear has been that you're going to call a convention and, you know, a group of lefties are going to come up and they're going to, the first thing they propose is going to be delete all and then call for the ayes, right? And that we're just not going to have the convention as the founders intended. And then we're going to start from scratch and they're going to end up giving us, you know, positive rights and the Second Bill of Rights and, you know, the formation of constitutional socialism. But the point that you're making is that that's not what could happen under an Article 5 convention.
It cannot. I mean, that's kind of the fear-mongering that's been going on for decades now with the opponents of this measure. And only the recent research has really clarified that. But the reason it can't happen, I mean, if you look at it this way, Walter, there's only one way to create a new amendment to the Constitution, and that is if three-fourths or 38 states ratify it, approve it. So it has to come from a proposed amendment first. So where does that proposed amendment come from? It can come from only one of two places, Congress or from we the people working through our state legislatures and a convention for proposing amendments. But you could, you know, there are other safeguards in the initial process that would prevent this from ever happening, but let's say by some crazy way, it actually, a proposed amendment went all the way through the convention process. Well, what did you have? You don't have anything because it's not been ratified yet. And the idea that three-fourths of the states would ratify something crazy is just untenable.
All right, I want to pause on that point because I think that notion of the states ratifying something that's crazy could be applied in either ideological direction, and I'll expand upon what I mean when we return with Steve Davidson, who's on the line with us to talk about the Convention of States. Conventionofstates.com is the place you can go find out more about it. 651-989-5855 if you want to join our conversation. Closing argument. My name is Walter Hudson, Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM, TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com. We're talking about an esoteric yet powerful way to restore the republic. When all else fails, when doing the same thing over and over, supporting the same candidates, electing the same people, supporting the same parties, does not succeed in limiting the size and scope of government and protecting our liberties, what option is left to us? Well, one such option is articulated and codified in Article 5 of the Constitution, and that is the Convention of States, a convention to propose amendments to that Constitution and it thus restructure the federal bureaucracy. We're talking about it with Steve Davidson, a spokesman for the Convention of States, tonight on Closing Argument. My name is Walter Hudson, 651-989-5855. Got Steve back on the line. So when we went to the break, you were mentioning the safeguard, as you see it, of any proposed amendments having to be both approved by three-fourths of the states who are represented at the convention itself and then ratified by, is it also three-fourths?
Actually, Walter, coming out of the convention, it would just be majority vote.
Okay,
so there'll be 50 states sending delegates to the convention.
Gotcha.
They will propose specifically worded proposed amendments, debate them, and vote on them. But the vote would be just a majority vote. But then it goes back to the states.
Right. And three-fourths of the states have to ratify it.
Yes, exactly right.
So what you were pointing out was that serves as a safeguard against crazy amendments. You know, the notion that the left is going to take over this thing and propose things that are going to take us further in the direction of socialism or reduction of our liberties because three-fourths of the states would have to ratify it. And so my question on that premise would be, it seems as though we're assuming that what the public at large would consider to be a crazy amendment is something that you and I and other conservatives would consider to be a crazy amendment. But isn't it possible that an amendment proposed, but for instance, I haven't read Levin's book, but his liberty amendments that have gained popularity amongst conservatives, that those amendments would be regarded as crazy by the majority or even enough states, enough people to block the ratification?
Yes. Well, maybe let's walk through it a little bit and see if we can kind of address that a little bit. The process starts when two-thirds of the states convince their state legislators to pass a resolution. And what's critical here is that the resolution has to be worded basically the same for all 34 states that would start the process, the two-thirds of states that would pass the request, if you will. And the one being put forward by our group, it's actually a three-part topic. It's number one is to impose fiscal constraints on the federal government. Number two, limit the power and jurisdiction of the federal government. And three, limit the terms of office for its officials and members of Congress. Now, all 34 states have to have this in their resolution, because there have been more than 400 attempts in our nation's history to use an Article 5 convention process, but it's always failed because the states could never agree to the topic. Now, this topic controls what can be discussed at the convention for proposing amendments. In other words, a delegate could not step outside of these topics and, for example, say, I think we should propose an amendment to repeal the Second Amendment.
Right.
He would be declared out of order because he doesn't follow the purpose of the convention. Didn't fall under that umbrella topic. And so once the convention is in process, these are the only areas that can be discussed. It's controlled that way. And that's another one of the safeguards. And remember, going into it, you've already got two-thirds of the states that agree to this topic.
Mm-hmm.
So that's already a fairly powerful political coalition, if you will. And then it just gets even more serious when you get to the ratification stage and the three-fourths of states necessary. So it's a high bar, intentionally so, and good that it is. But in the end, you can pretty well count on the fact that the will of the people is expressed if three-fourths of the states ratify it. And it's actually more interesting than that, because there are 99 individual state Senate and House bodies, if you will. And what does it take for one state to reject an unwanted proposed amendment? All they have to do is have one of their legislative bodies simply fail to bring it up for a vote, and it fails in that state.
Mm-hmm.
So if you do the math, it means that as few as 13 out of 99 state legislative bodies is all it takes to reject an unwanted proposed amendment. So it's a very high bar.
You've mentioned throughout our conversation thus far tonight the opponents of this convention of states idea, and I'm curious as to who those opponents are and what if there's kind of an ideological unity to them. Are they all from the left, or are there opponents on the right as well? And I'm interested in understanding their arguments and their motivations.
Okay. It's very interesting, and I'd refer your listeners to an article, an academic paper done by Professor Robert G. Nadelson. It's on our website, conventionofstates.com. Click on resources, click on responses to opposition. It's a study of this opposition. And turns out it actually began back in the early 60s when, I have to say, mostly liberal folks had gained great power in the federal government, and they realized what a threat this was to their power. And so academics, politicians, others started to pump out articles warning us of the dangers, yet they had no research base for their claims. It was just kind of a phenomenal blitz, if you will, of all kinds of articles. And this is where it actually started. And they did such an impressive job of it that some organizations on the right even picked up on that, and they still continue today to stand in opposition. Now, you asked about a motive. I really don't quite understand the zealous nature of the opposition, other than, you know, it's those who either are in power or who really like power in Washington, D.C.,
right,
are responsible for the opposition.
651-989-5855 is the number to join us. We're talking with Steve Davidson, a spokesman for the Convention of States Project, that's working to call a convention to propose amendments to the United States Constitution in order to limit that behemoth government. We'll continue talking with him when we return and take your calls as well. Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM, TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com. That Donald Trump regularly said on the campaign trail, the top two things that I think were most popular and most influential in getting him elected were, number one, build the wall, right? Build the wall resonates to this day. Still widely said, widely chanted. And the second thing, number two, nipping at its heels, was drain the swamp. Drain the swamp. Now, what do we mean by draining the swamp? Draining the swamp has always kind of had a certain ambiguity to it in terms of, you know, what it is that we're talking about. I always took it to mean, or hoped that it would mean, that if elected, Donald Trump was going to go after the federal bureaucracy. He was going to go after the bureaucrats and the administrators, the deep state, as it has come to be called. Those people who don't really worry too much about who gets elected because they're going to remain regardless. You know, the new hot-headed Tea Partier who was just elected to Congress doesn't really intimidate them at all because they know that that person might be gone in 2 years, whereas they've been there for 20 and they know they'll be there for 20 more, right? And they have power. They have regulatory power. They have rulemaking ability. They have administrative control. And so, you know, in some ways, they wield more secure and potent control over Americans' lives than elected members of Congress, and they know it. So how do we actually drain that swamp? Well, one potential option is being discussed here tonight on Closing Argument. My name is Walter Atson, Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM, streaming at TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com and your iHeartRadio app. We are here 8 to 10 weeknights. You can join us at 651-989-5855. We're talking with Steve Davidson, a representative of the Convention of States Project, and they are working to organize politically within the several states to call a constitutional convention, a convention for the purpose of proposing amendments to the Constitution. It's known as an Article 5 convention, and that could have the effect of draining that proverbial swamp. Steve, welcome back to the show.
Thank you.
So I wanted to ask you about how much progress has been made in this endeavor, because this is something that's been going on for, you know, as we stated at the outset, many years, this effort to call a Article 5 convention. How close are we?
We're getting closer all the time, and I would maybe make the distinction here. There are several different movements that have been going on for a long time. One that calls for the single-issue balanced budget amendment, another one that calls for term limits alone. I mean, I'm talking, these movements are independent of the one that I'm volunteering for. The one we have has the three subtopics. It actually does a more complete job of kind of fixing Washington, D.C., and in your lead-in here, you talked about draining the swamp, and the second point, limit the power and jurisdiction of the federal government, that's the one that kind of goes after the tremendous power that's centered in these government agencies.
Right.
The thousands of regulations that come out every year, and we have to follow them just as if Congress had passed them,
yeah,
although they're coming out from unelected unaccountable bureaucrats. And so that part of it's a very important part, and one maybe that's a little more difficult to grasp. But, you know, they had a simulated convention of states a couple of years ago in Williamsburg, Virginia, and the proposed amendment, and this was a practice thing, it lasted 3 days, but they had actual state legislators there, 137, I think, attended from all 50 states, and they broke in committees. But the interesting one that came out of the Limit the Power and Jurisdiction of the Federal Government Committee was that by a three-fifths vote of the states, any executive order from a president, any regulation from a federal agency, or any law by Congress could be rejected. This would really swing power back to the states where the founding fathers intended it, but it would have a special big effect on these bureaucracies. And that, along with imposing fiscal constraints, the idea would be to have proposed amendments that would greatly reduce their size, the enormity of them, and bring them into a reasonable level where they're actually doing the basic things they're supposed to do, I guess that's the way I put it.
Yeah, that was the next thing I was going to ask you about as I was perusing the website, which for folks' consideration is conventionofstates.com. You have information there, quite a bit of information actually, about the simulated convention of states that took place, and you guys went all out, you went full bore in terms of actually going through the simulated process of what this convention would look like, and I have some questions. So, you know, I'm looking at the proposed amendments that came out of this simulated convention, and they look good. They look fantastic in terms of the limitations they would place upon the federal government and scaling it back to its originally intended purpose and freeing up the states and the people in those states to live their lives according to their own judgment. My question is, and you kind of half answered it already, who were these people? Because when you go and you look at the votes, like, for instance, I'll just give an example here. The one proposed amendment was to have the fiscal restraints placed upon the federal government where the public debt shall not be increased except upon a recorded vote of 2/3 of each House of Congress, and only for a period not to exceed 1 year, and then they have two other sections to go along with that. The vote was 45 in support, and it lists all the states that voted in support, and only 3 opposed, and then 2 abstained. So overwhelming support for the fiscal restraint proposed constitutional amendment, which raises the question, who are these people? Are these cherry-picked conservative activists who would tend to go along with this sort of thing? Or is this truly representative of where the American people are at?
I really don't know how the numbers broke down. They were primarily from the conservative side, I'm sure. Just like the 3 that attended from Minnesota were all Republicans. Mm-hmm. But I do know that there were Democrats involved, and I've seen some of them in interviews surrounding that practice convention of states. But it was, you know, probably certainly leaning towards the conservative side. But again, you know, these amendments that are being proposed and the same way in the simulation, in a large way, it really is nonpartisan, because the debt, for example, $2.1 trillion, that doesn't matter whether you're the children and grandchildren of Democrats or Republicans are going to pay a huge price down the road. Same with the other issues surrounding this. The effect is on all Americans, and that's part of the education process as well.
Yeah. Very much appreciate you taking the time to join us tonight, Steve Davidson. Again, the website for more information is conventionofstates.com. Article 5 Convention, a process by which we can restore the republic. Appreciate you coming on. We'll have you on again sometime.
All right. Walter, we're going to have a big rally on Monday at the Capitol Rotunda. I invite everyone to come out and hear Pete Hegseth, it'll be a great event.
So that's going to be on Monday at what time?
1:30 in the Capitol Rotunda, the beautiful new renovated Capitol Rotunda. 1:30, we've got several speakers, including Pete Hegseth. and it's just going to be a blast.
All right. Fantastic. Thanks for letting us know about it, and I'm sure we will definitely see many of our listeners there. Maybe I'll even drop by. Appreciate you once again coming on the program. Take care.
Thank you very much.
We'll talk to Ted from Minneapolis and get into some other news of the day in our final segment of tonight when we return. 651-989-5855. Closing argument. My name is Walter Atson, Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM, TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com. Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM, closing argument. My name is Walter Hudson. Our final segment of the evening. You can join us, 651-989-5855. Indeed, it's our final segment of the week. We're going to have our Gophers hockey preempting us tomorrow evening, so enjoy the game. Let's talk to Ted in Minneapolis. Welcome to the program.
Hey, Walter.
Hey.
Yeah, I just want to talk about this all but certain announcement by Amy Klobuchar that she's going to run for president.
Yeah.
And the local, you know, major radio station, they're trying to portray her as a centrist who really shined during the Kavanaugh hearings.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And then Tom Emmer comes out today and says, don't underestimate her, and she's really done a lot of great things for our state. And I'm thinking, wait a minute, now she votes 100% of the time with the hard left.
Mm-hmm.
And then he's saying that she's done a lot of good for our state. And then I just think she's been an empty suit. She's just been totally absent when it comes to the national debt,
mm-hmm.
defense, military matters, Russia, China,
yeah.
Iran. She never, ever talked.
Ted?
Softballs.
Okay.
And that's why she got to where she is. And
yeah, I got to tell you, I got a little hung up on you citing Tom Emmer because, you know, I consider Tom a friend. He's my congressman, and I know a lot of people that work for him. And I look up to the guy, to be frank. And it's troublesome to me that he felt the need to say that publicly. Like, I understand feeling that way. Like, you can legitimately think and acknowledge that Amy Klobuchar has done some good things for Minnesota. I don't have a problem with having that opinion. But in the context of her potentially announcing her campaign for president of the United States, to offer that publicly seems, and look, if we lived in a different world, and this is the problem I have with Republicans generally, if we lived in a world where they really were, where things were the way they were supposed to be, where we all shared the same goals and just disagreed as the means to achieve them, then that type of statement, like, you know, decorum would be entirely appropriate. But that's not the world we live in. We live in a world where one side, one of the political parties, the Democrats, of which Amy Klobuchar is a rising star and a prominent fixture here in Minnesota, is hell-bent on destroying everything that we hold dear in the United States of America and taking away our individual liberties and our freedoms. Why in God's name? And this is you saw the same thing with Jeff Johnson during the governor's race. Between him and Tim Walz.
Nice guy.
Yeah, he was constantly talking about what a nice guy his opponent was. Are you kidding me? Like, so I guess I should vote for him then. Like, you're not telling me why I should vote for you by telling me how great the other person is.
Yeah, I think he might just be doing that for job security because he's probably thinking that, well, if he supports her, then all the Democrats are going to support him. They're not going to support him.
I'm not that cynical. and knowing Tom a little bit, I don't think that's the calculation that he's making. I think he was just trying to be nice. And, you know, when you've got somebody on the phone or with a mic in your face, whatever the case may be, asking you about a colleague that you run into and actually see in Washington, D.C., the impulse is going to be to say something nice. But it should have been a little bit more calculated, is all I'm saying.
Yeah, these Democrats, they all try to portray themselves as centrists. But yet they vote 100% of the time with the hard left. So what part, I don't understand where they come. R.T. Ryback used to describe himself as a centrist. That guy's as liberal as you get.
Yeah, there's nothing centrist about taking away people's liberty. I appreciate the call, Ted. Yeah. All right, I want to end the show tonight by sharing this piece from The Blaze regarding our distant countrymen over in New York. They have an objection to a certain economic reality that they find themselves facing in the aftermath of an increase in their minimum wage to $15. Some New Yorkers are displeased with one of the more predictable outcomes of that new minimum wage set at $15. As it turns out, restaurants all over the city are raising their prices. According to the New York Post, the city's minimum wage, it's a municipal minimum wage, much like the one that Minneapolis has, the one that St. Paul is considering, went to $15 from $13, or $13.50 at the beginning of 2019, boosting the paychecks of numerous lower-wage workers. Those who rely on restaurants regularly for their daily lunches, however, aren't as happy. It's obnoxious, kind of a slap in the face, Starbucks patron Ed Beck told the Post. Another increase, and I won't come back. Now, it doesn't mention what Mr. Edward Beck's politics is, whether or not he supported the increase in the minimum wage or not. For the time being, I'll set that consideration and potential hypocrisy aside and just note that, you know, as they state here at the Blaze, this is an entirely predictable outcome of raising the minimum wage, right? I mean, when you tell a business that they have to pay more for the same amount of value, because it's not as though raising somebody's wage from $13 to $15 somehow magically generates that extra $2 of value in the activities that that employee is engaged in. You're taking it right out of your profit. You're taking it right out of your revenue, your operating budget, your capacity to run your business. That's where that money is coming from. And so in order to recoup that, there's only so many things you can do. And one of them is raising prices. But the funny thing about that is when you raise prices on something like a lunch at a restaurant in New York City, you're going to get some pushback from your customers. And that's what Edward Beck's comment speaks to. He says, another increase and I won't come back. Now, so here's my question for the advocates of increases in the minimum wage. What do you think's going to happen to your beloved employee who deserves a living wage? What do you think's going to happen to them now that they have two extra dollars on their paycheck today, when the Edward Becks of the world decide they're not going to patronize that restaurant anymore? How long is their job going to continue to exist? How long is it going to be until somebody has to be fired or some other scale back has to be made in order to accommodate the new higher wage? And is it worth it? Is it worth it for the survivors of what you have done by imposing a minimum wage? Now, you know, this is an issue, a dynamic that I never, ever have heard addressed by anybody on the left. They just pretend that it doesn't exist. They pretend as though there is no economic consequence to artificially raising the price of labor.
I don't think they're pretending. They just don't know.
So you think they sincerely don't know?
No. Why would anyone with an economics degree, other than maybe Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, be a leftist?
I mean, there's a whole lot of people with economics degrees who are leftists, and the entire faculty of any given university, you know. So I don't know. I think it's conscientious. I think they see that it's good politics. It's always good politics to promise something that gives, theoretically or rhetorically, gives somebody more than they had yesterday, regardless of the actual deteriorating and destructive effect it has upon their lives in the long term. Closing argument. My name is Walter Hudson. 8 to 10 weeknights. We'll see you guys next week. TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com.